Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into some really ancient, shadowy corners of Greek mythology.
The very beginnings.
Exactly. We're going to try and shed some light on figures that, often get blurred together, the primordial entities Erebus and Tartarus.
Yeah, they definitely get confused quite a bit.
You've probably heard these names, maybe even used them interchangeably, but they represent, well, truly distinct and foundational concepts in the ancient world. So our mission today is to take your sources looking at Hesiod's Theogony, which is like the bedrock of Greek cosmology, right?
Absolutely fundamental.
And comparing that with modern discussions and analyses and just bring some clarity, help you distinguish between these powerful cosmic forces and understand their significance.
Sounds good. It's important to get these foundational concepts straight.
Have you ever really tried to define pure absolute darkness? Just darkness itself.
It's a tough concept.
Or pictured a prison so deep it makes, our toughest maximum security facilities look like a playground.
Right. The scale is just mind-boggling.
That's the kind of depth we're exploring today. And I promise it's going to be an illuminating journey into the gloom in the best possible way.
Looking forward to it.
So where do we begin our journey into this ancient darkness? Let's start with Erebus. I think many people might just think of it as a god of darkness.
Right, that's the common understanding.
But in Greek mythology, it's often described as darkness itself. What can you tell us about that foundational idea?
Well, that's a really crucial distinction. Erebus isn't a father like Zeus, with a personality or a story arc.
No myths about his adventures.
Not really. It's a primordial deity. That means it existed right from the very inception of the cosmos, one of the first beings to emerge. According to Hesiod's Theogony, Erebus is the direct offspring of chaos. That formless void everything sprang from.
Right, the absolute beginning.
So Erebus fundamentally exists as an intrinsic part of the universe. It doesn't really take a physical form we'd recognize. It is the gloom, the darkness.
And its name, I understand, really reinforces this idea, this fundamental darkness.
Exactly. The name Erebus itself literally means darkness or gloom, often specifically the darkness of the underworld. And it's such an ancient concept, you can trace its linguistic roots across, well, lots of early European languages.
Like what?
We see related words, cognates, like the Old Norse rúkr, meaning dark or dust, or even the Armenian erek, which means evening, just signifies this deep, fundamental, inescapable absence of light.
Okay, here's where I found it gets really interesting and maybe a bit counterintuitive. This primordial darkness, Erebus, actually gives birth to light. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a truly brilliant piece of early Greek cosmological thinking. It shows how they were grappling with creation, In Hesiod's account, Erebus mates with Nyx, who is his sibling, and the personification of night.
Darkness and night.
And from this union, they produce Aether, who embodies light and the bright blue sky, and Hemera, who is day.
So darkness isn't just bad
Yeah,
or an end.
exactly. It's not a simple good versus evil thing. It's this fundamental balance. It suggests darkness isn't just an endpoint, but actually a necessary precursor for light and day to even emerge.
That's surprisingly sophisticated, really.
It is. It suggests this inherent cyclical nature to the cosmos. Pretty advanced stuff for its time.
And Erebus's children aren't just limited to light and day, are they? I read that later authors, especially the Romans, attributed a whole host of other concepts to Erebus's parentage.
Oh, absolutely. The family tree, if you can call it that, gets much bigger. In different cosmogonies, and especially through Roman authors like Cicero and Hyginus, who often just swapped in Nox for Nyx, the Roman equivalent Erebus is described as a father to a huge array of personified concepts.
Like what kind of concepts?
Well, everything from Eros or Amor in Latin, which is love.
Wait, love comes from darkness?
In some versions, yes, but also more abstract, maybe darker. Notions like guile, dolus, fear, matus, toil, labor, envy, invidentia, fate, fatum, old age, nectus, death, mors, misery, miseria.
Wow, that's quite a brood.
And even the demons, these were early spiritual beings, kind of between gods and mortals, maybe precursors to our modern idea of demons, but not quite the same thing back then.
That is a lot of different parentage. And it even sounds a little contradictory sometimes, doesn't it? Why do we see so many variations? All these different children, often conflicting across the myths.
That's a really perceptive question, and it gets to the heart of understanding Greek mythology itself.
How so?
Well, it wasn't a single fixed book like a Bible. It was more like a living collection of stories from lots of different authors over centuries: Hesiod, Euclid, Philodemus, Aristophanes, the Orphics, later the Romans.
Right, not one unified canon.
Exactly. Each account often had conflicting details because authors were trying to explain the origins and the nature of the world in their own way. Hmm. You know, they were all trying to make sense of the universe, so the stories naturally evolved and adapted depending on the, well, the philosophical or cultural context of the time.
Okay, that makes sense. It wasn't set in stone.
Not at all.
All right, now that we've kind of explored the pure darkness of Erebus, let's shift our gaze. Let's talk about another primordial entity, Tartarus.
Right, Tartarus.
This is a realm often intertwined with Erebus in people's minds, but it's profoundly distinct, famously described as, what was it? As far beneath Hades as heaven is above earth.
Yes, that line from Hesiod really sticks with you. And Tartarus is unique because it's both a deity and a specific terrifying location.
So a being and a place?
Exactly. As a deity, Hesiod names Tartarus as the third primordial, right after Chaos and Gaia, Earth, even before Eros, love.
Okay.
But as a location, it's depicted as the deepest, most dreadful part of the underworld. It's the ultimate dungeon of torment and suffering, the pit.
And the scale is just immense, right? You mentioned Hesiod.
Oh, yeah. To really grasp it, think about that detail from the Theogony. If a bronze anvil were to fall from heaven, it would take 9 days to reach Earth.
9 days, okay.
And then it would take another 9 days to fall from Earth down to Tartarus.
18 days falling, yeah. Just, oh.
It really paints a picture of its unfathomable depth, doesn't it? It emphasizes its role as the absolute lowest point of existence.
And its original purpose was pretty specific, too. A prison, but for really powerful beings. I think Uranos, the sky, was the first jailer.
Yes, that's right. Uranos imprisoned the monstrous Cyclops and the Hecatonchars, the hundred-handed ones down there, because he feared their strength.
Understandable, maybe.
Then later, his son Cronus kept them imprisoned, even setting this fearsome dragon-like creature, Campy, as their guard.
So a prison from the very beginning.
Pretty much. But the most famous residents, of course, became the Titans themselves.
Ah, the Titanomachy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
After that epic, colossal war between the older gods and Zeus's Olympians, well, Zeus won. He defeated Cronus and many of the other Titans who fought against him, and he banished them to Tartarus.
And who guarded them then?
Well, in a fantastic twist of fate, the very beings who were once prisoners there, the mighty Hecatonchars, the hundred-handers, they became the formidable guards, making sure the Titans stayed locked away forever.
So the Titans, these huge figures, cast into this specific prison. But what's fascinating, and maybe less known, is that Tartarus wasn't just for gods and Titans.
Right.
It later evolved, didn't it, into a place for mortals, too. But not just any mortals.
No, definitely not. These were individuals who had truly, spectacularly angered the gods. They were destined for unique, often symbolic, eternal torments.
Okay, tell us about some of those. The punishments are famous.
They really are iconic. And they're usually perfectly linked to the crime, showing this profound sense of poetic justice.
Like Sisyphus.
Sisyphus is probably the most famous. He tricked Thanatos, death himself.
Yeah.
Even tried to cheat the gods, massively overstepped his bounds.
That's all hushman.
To eternally roll a massive boulder uphill, only for it to roll back down every single time he gets near the top. A never-ending cycle of just utter futility.
Ugh, you can almost feel the exhaustion just thinking about it. Soul-crushing.
Absolutely. And then there's Tantalus. His name basically means to be tormented, right?
Yeah, we get the word tantalize from him.
Exactly. He committed the ultimate sacrilege, cooked his own son for the gods, and stole ambrosia, their divine food.
Horrific.
So he was condemned to eternal hunger and thirst. He stands at a pool of water that recedes when he tries to drink, with fruit hanging just above him, always swaying just out of reach, forever tantalized.
Wow. Okay, who else?
Well, there's Ixion. He committed the first kin-related murder, a huge taboo, and then brazenly tried to seduce Hera, Zeus's wife.
Bad move.
Very bad move. He was tied to a winged, flaming wheel that spins eternally through Tartarus.
A flaming wheel. Okay.
And the Danaes' 50 sisters who murdered their husbands on their wedding night, they were forced to carry water in leaky jugs, trying to fill a cracked bath. Another endlessly futile task.
Leaky jugs seems fitting.
And finally, Pythios. He attempted to rape Leto, the mother of Apollo and Artemis. He was stretched out in Tartarus, covering acres, while two vultures perpetually feasted on his liver, which would regenerate each night.
Ouch. That sounds a bit like Prometheus's punishment, too.
Very similar, yes. A recurring motif of eternal physical torment.
It sounds like a truly brutal, an incredibly imaginative system of justice. So who decided? Who got this particularly harsh treatment? Were there judges?
Oh, it wasn't arbitrary. There were specific judges of the dead.
Oh.
Rhadamanthus, who judged the souls from Asia, Aeacus, who judged the Europeans, and Minos, who was originally the king of Crete, he had the deciding vote and judged the Greeks.
And they decided who was curable versus incurable.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah.
They determined who was destined for Tartarus.
And if we look beyond just the myths, I know philosophers like Plato picked up on this too.
He did, yes. If you connect this to philosophical depth, Plato's Gorgias dialogue talks about souls being judged after death.
What did Plato say?
He describes the uncurable sinners, tyrants, temple robbers, murderers, the worst of the worst facing eternal torment in Tartarus. But crucially, it served as a permanent warning, an example to the living.
So, a deterrent.
Exactly. But he also mentioned curable souls. Perhaps those who regretted their actions or maybe committed involuntary manslaughter. They could potentially be purified or even released after seeking forgiveness from those they wronged.
So a blend of absolute justice and maybe a sliver of hope, or at least purpose.
A fascinating blend, yes. Even within the grimness of it all.
The Romans also had their own very vivid depictions of Tartarus, didn't they? Virgil comes to mind.
Oh, definitely. Virgil, in the Aeneid, paints quite a terrifying picture. He describes Tartarus as surrounded by three massive walls.
Three walls.
Yes, and beyond them flows the Phlegethon, a river of fire, emphasizing that burning torment.
Sounds intense.
And it's guarded by a hydra with 50 gaping, snarling jaws, plus Tisiphone, one of the Erinyes, the Furies, standing sleepless guard, constantly lashing her whip. Just a place of pure, inescapable terror and retribution.
Yikes. And it's fascinating how the concept itself, Tartarus, actually extends beyond just Greco-Roman myths. It pops up in some surprising places later on.
Absolutely. Its impact was widespread. You even find the term Tartarus used in certain biblical pseudepigrapha. Mm-hmm. Those are ancient writings, kind of related to the Bible, but not officially in the canon.
Really? What for?
And even in the New Testament itself, in 2 Peter, it's used to describe a place of imprisonment specifically for fallen angels.
Fallen angels.
Wow.
Yeah, it shows how powerful and enduring this concept of an ultimate abyss, a place of divine retribution, became across different cultures and belief systems. Its influence really spread.
Okay, so we've explored these powerful entities individually. We've got Erebus, the darkness, and Tartarus, the abyss. The big question remains, how do they really fit together? What truly sets Erebus, Tartarus, and the broader underworld apart? It's still easy to get them mixed up.
It is, and that's a crucial distinction to make. This is where understanding the layers of Greek cosmology really helps.
Okay, break it down for us.
So Erebus, primarily the primordial personification of darkness itself. It's a fundamental cosmic element, the necessary precursor to light. It can also sometimes refer to the gloomy passage or region souls pass through on their way to Hades proper. Think of it as the raw, unformed darkness, more of an existence or a state than a physical place with walls and guards.
Got it. Darkness as a concept, maybe a region.
Right. Then Tartarus. It's both a primordial entity like Erebus, but much more importantly, it's a specific, distinct location, usually depicted as within or even beneath the general underworld.
The pit.
The pit, the deepest abyss. Its main function is as the ultimate prison for incredibly powerful beings like the Titans, and later for the most wicked mortal sinners facing those unique eternal punishments. It embodies cosmic consequences, divine retribution, defined by its depth and its punitive role.
Okay. Erebus is darkness. Tartarus is the prison pit. So where does Hades fit in? The underworld.
Hades, or the underworld, is the overarching realm of the dead, ruled by the god Hades. It's the whole kit and caboodle. It encompasses various regions. You've got the Asphodel fields, where most ordinary souls just sort of drift aimlessly, kind of bleak.
Not exactly fun.
No. Then you have the Elysian fields, or Elysium, for the blessed, the heroes. A much nicer place. And the fields of mourning, for those who died of lost love. Tartarus is typically considered the lowest and worst part of this bigger realm, or sometimes even a separate, deeper dimension beneath Hades altogether.
So the underworld isn't all just fire and brimstone. Tartarus is the really bad neighborhood.
Exactly. Your average soul in Hades wasn't necessarily being actively tortured, just existing in a shadowy, lifeless state. Tartarus is where the real active suffering happened. Makes the distinction pretty clear, right?
Yeah, that helps a lot. So what does all this mean for you listening in? As someone curious about these ancient stories and how they shaped, well, human thought, why does this distinction matter for us today?
Well, these concepts were the ancient Greeks' profound way of explaining fundamental dualities. you know, light and dark, creation and consequence, cosmic order versus chaos, and moral justice.
Making sense of the world.
Exactly. They help make sense of the vast, often terrifying, universe and humanity's place within it. They provided a framework for understanding why things are the way they are.
And it wasn't just about punishment either, right? You mentioned Erebus and light.
Right. What's truly insightful is how these early myths grapple with creation itself and that inherent balance. It's not just good versus evil. It's this primal understanding that even within the deepest darkness, Erebus lies the very potential for light in existence to emerge. That's quite a thought.
It really is. And it's just fascinating how these ancient myths keep shaping our imagination, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Even today, you see echoes of Tartarus all over the place. Like in popular culture, you get things called the Fields of Punishment in books or games.
Yeah, yeah.
It shows how these ideas of, you know, ultimate justice and deserved suffering really resonate and stick with us. They keep inspiring new stories about consequence.
They definitely have a long shadow.
So we've journeyed through the enveloping gloom of Erebus, the primordial dark. We've witnessed the truly abyssal torments of Tartarus. And hopefully we've clarified their distinct yet interconnected places within that complex tapestry of the Greek underworld. It does put things in perspective.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, these myths remind us that even in the most ancient ways of understanding the universe, there was this profound recognition of both the darkness everything came from.
Erebus.
And the inescapable consequences for challenging the cosmic order or, you know, committing truly unforgivable acts.
Tartarus.
They're not just cool, scary stories. They're reflections of these really deep universal concerns about creation, morality, and justice that we still grapple with.
Hmm. Maybe the true deep dive then for you to think about is, what does modern darkness look like in our stories? Or what constitutes an ultimate punishment in our contemporary imagination? And how much do those ideas still reflect these ancient primordial fears and fascinations we've talked about today?
That's a great question.
Definitely something to ponder until next time.